It is punctuated here and there by a new idea. Some of those ideas are good, and some only complicate the situation. But anyway, the human being quietly has to recognize that none of these things need to move him. He does not need to be wrong because being wrong is fashionable. He doesn't need to remain ignorant because wisdom looks like a responsibility. He does not need to neglect his inner life in the desperate effort to become physically opulent and successful. How we got the way we have is difficult to imagine because the truth of the thing is so obvious. And of course, the simple answer to the whole business is that success, for most persons, has to end at the grave. All the things we have piled up here, we simply leave to our relatives or our descendants to haggle over. We cannot take with us anything except, if something, what we have achieved internally. We are supposed by nature to leave this world a little wiser and a little better than when we came in. If this is a failure, if we do not know more on our deathbed than we did in the cradle, then we have failed. And that is the problem. In fact, it's worse, because when we were children, we only knew or were only ignorant, simple ignorance. Whereas as we get older, to follow the Confucian adage, we come to the time when we know not and know not that we know not. Instead of being simply ignorant, we become compoundly ignorant. That is, we have reached the point where we not only do not know the truth, but have accepted so many things that are untrue that it's almost impossible to extricate our mind from the dilemma. So actually, the problem of making something out of life is not as difficult, dangerous, or terrible as we might think. It is simply a matter of building internal value. Now, at the beginning, it will probably be a bit sketchy. We're not going to start in by being stupendously enlightened. But we are going to gradually begin to recognize, as Buddha did, that the first step is difficult. But if you take it wisely, it justifies all the other steps. The first step is the difficult one, because it means that we step from a condition of compound ignorance to the beginning of a search for wisdom. In the first step, we may fall on our face. Quite possible, because we don't know where we're going. But first step is dedication. It is a determination to be better. It tells us firmly that we are not living our own potential. The first step is to realize that there is something better inside of us than we have ever permitted to come out on the outside. That there is more inside of us than we'll ever find on the outside. And that the treasures of the inner life have an endurance, whereas the treasures of the outer life, if they are physical, will be taxed to death, and if they are not physical and taxable, we must leave them at the grave. So all these different problems brought out the concept that Confucius had of what might be termed a good average person. His superior man was not something that walks around on high boots and lords it over others. His superior man is not one that is loaded down with credentials. His superior man is not one who is too good to mingle with anyone else. His superior man is simply an individual who has found his own center and is going to try to live according to it. And in so doing, he has also solved the problem of his relationships with other people. The superior person is not one who lords it over others. He is the most humble and simple of all people because he has a depth of values which enable him to understand the mistakes of everyone except himself. Though he has his own mistakes, he has to struggle through. But these mistakes of others he can philosophize upon with considerable ability and with constructive results. Confucian, not having had a computer to work with, we now find what is happening. It used to be that we taught children the three R's: reading, writing, and arithmetic. In those days, we spelt arithmetic with an R. These simple facts were very awesome when you started out. The multiplication table looked desperate at first, but it gradually took common shape, and first you know, we were able to add up grocery bills with comparative convenience. Little by little, education taught us things. It taught us to learn certain things. And education in contact with other people brought out certain points that were valuable. But now, if we allow computerization to do our thinking for us, to enable us to solve all the problems of higher mathematics, for instance, because we know nothing about them ourselves, but the computer can give us the answers, we are going to have a new kind of ignorance, an ignorance based upon the misbelief that a mechanical device can think and has proper moral integrities. The problem of the computer will be its lack of morals, and without its morals, it can be an instrument of destruction. We are already overtaxing the values of it. Already we are obsoleting model after model and selling them off for 10% of what they cost. Anything for a quick profit. There's no really a quick profit in the computer than any other factor. All values have to be slowly and carefully earned. The individual has to feel the weight of responsibility to grow, to mature his values, and to become a thoughtful person. In other words, as Confucius would have put it, he had to put an iron control upon himself. Now, at first, a control seems a terrible thing, so the individual has never had any. It's like trying to break in a horse. The horse is going to be very difficult at first, and the individual's inner life, his mind, emotions, are an unbridled horse, which he has been feeding for a long time and patting occasionally, but has done nothing to discipline or prepare for useful futures. So we all have to find some way to get at this thing. And, of course, Confucius had his ideas of how this was to be done also. One thing he observed or remarked clearly was that it was necessary to use the sensory perceptions not as instruments of pleasure, but as instruments of information. In other words, your eyes are to look for things worth seeing. Your ears are to listen to things worth hearing. But if you use your eyes only to amuse yourself, or you use your hearing only to listen to rock music, you're liable to have difficulties. All these sensory perceptions must be used constructively to tell us things. They must tell us when we make a mistake. They must tell us when we have overdone something or neglected something. These faculties are there to make bridges between our own minds and the natural world around us, which has principles and truths that we need to understand. So we simply use these faculties not to surfeit them, not to indulge them, not to fall into a sort of intoxication of the mind, but to strip it of its superficial addictions and like it into a very definite program of purposed growth. This we have to do, or else we will go out of this world as we came in. And that is really too bad, because it's, and according to Buddhist philosophy, it merely means we come back with a heavier load of karma than we should. We should be paying karma, not making it. We should be getting over the sins of the past rather than trying to carry them joyously into the sins of the future. We need to understand life. Now, Confucius was not a dour character. He wasn't one of those old wise men who looked very difficult to know or understand or contact. He apparently had a wonderful sense of humor. And he was also given to divination and things like that. He wrote an elaborate commentary on the I Ching, which was one of the best that was ever written and is still included in most of the Chinese texts. He was interested in everything. And he also had a realization that the sciences were instruments of divination. Even reading, writing, and arithmetic have a magic in them. The magic of what they do to the mind helping to strengthen it and develop it. The individual who does not care about developing the mind is going to have sickness, he's going to have broken homes, he's going to lose his job, or stay on a very mediocre level as long as he lives. Now in Switzerland, for example, the Tibetan people who have been thrown or cast out of Tibet or have escaped as best they could are now fitting themselves into the life of Switzerland and are doing an extraordinary job of it. The young Tibetan children are now attending Swiss schools, and according to records published recently, most of those Tibetan children, although they came from another land and have had to learn a language, most of those children are at the head of their classes at this time. Why? Because their ancestry taught them that to learn is a privilege. Their background warned them of the importance of developing disciplines and strengths and to adjust to realities and to prepare to live in a constructive manner in a strange world that far from the one they've left behind. It was simply a matter of these young people having brought from Tibet with them an integrity which has not yet been destroyed, an integrity which makes a new reason for what they're doing. They are grateful for the chance of learning. Most of our people have a tendency to resent the responsibilities of learning. To them it is a bondage, and many of them feel that is justified because the type of learning they're getting is not what they want. Well, there are two sides to that coin. One is that they're probably right in many of their conclusions. They're not getting the education that they should get. But on the other hand, they are getting an education such as it is, much of which they need, regardless of its ineffectiveness. To reject the education we have does not mean that they have found a better one. And there's where the problem is. It means simply that they renounce education per se. They just walk out of school and become dropouts. If some of them are geniuses, they will win anyway, because you can't stop the mind that has already begun to think. But for most cases, they have damaged themselves. Whereas if they had at least a good psych, a good grammar school and high school education, they would have trained the mind into some kind of discipline. If it was only memory. They have put some responsibility upon their own thinking. They've had to give up a few foolish notions in a desperate effort to make an education support them. This is something. It is not perfect. It is not right. But it is what we have. But these same young people who have gone through this kind of discipline are ready for other discipline. And they can do what most wise people have found. Namely, that education really begins after you have graduated from school. Until then, you are limited by traditional superstitions, for the mores that you cannot do much about. Confucius, therefore, gave us the model of what he calls the right kind of person. This right kind of person is a homebody. The world begins in the human home. And according to Confucius, all of the relationships of life expand from family. The home is the one little island of integrities that can be established with some success by persons who are simply dedicated to kindness or understanding. The home becomes the basis of all knowledge. The home is made up sometimes of three or four generations, but all of these have their common understandings. Each one has its proprieties and its properties. The heads of the family will not badger the younger ones simply because they have authority, and the younger ones will not badger their elders because they do not like to be badgered in their turn. Everything is upon proper dignities. Every courtesy of life should be in the home. Confucius was bitterly opposed to the idea of behaving yourself in public and doing what you please in private. He didn't consider that a very good way of life. But upon the basis of the home comes the training of the children. And the child's mind is set by the time it is 8 or 10 years old. By that time, children divide into two groups. One group composed of those who want to get out of the home as quick as possible and do not care what happens to them. And the others who have been inspired to improve their lives and either to emulate the virtues of their ancestry or else stand firm against the vices of those around them. So the child becomes the basis of the empire. The neglect of the child is the most desperate evil in the world, according to Confucius. He said that where we do not give the children the proper background, we are crippling the adult. The ruts we set in the mind by our own attitudes and the false opinions which are set there in very early life are almost impossible to eradicate. They are gullies and valleys and cliffs and precipices in the mental structure which become a detriment to all constructive thinking. So, and after the beginning of it, so says Confucius, the family has also a worship. A worship is a kind of respect. To Confucius, veneration is respect, and it has to be earned. And it is the privilege and right of every individual to be respected, but he has to deserve it. So Confucius pointed out very definitely that in the home, every dignity, every propriety, every integrity that we would like to see applied to society is being cultivated and practiced. That the home is not a place in where evils are practiced in secret, but where virtues are practiced both secretly and publicly. So the home is very, very important. An intelligent home is the strongest factor in the survival of a nation or a civilization. After the strength and value of the home comes the next level, and that is the recognition that we are all here to have certain relationships with society around us, that the home has to expand. The town becomes the home. The city becomes the home. And each individual, in his own way, must try to be a good citizen as he was a good member of his own family. All units of culture are families, and all families are made up of persons who live in respectful relationship with others. Every courtesy and dignity of life is practiced first in the home and then in society. And in everything that happens, integrities are rewarded, and we do business with those who are honest and not those who sell it a little cheaper. We are trying constantly to perform the ethics and integrities which make society possible. And from there on, we have duties to perform. We and the Hindus brought over into China certain concepts of duty, and these were taken in by Confucius, Mencius, and Lao Tzu. These duties are the duty of the family and the householder. The individual who has been raised and lovingly cared for in a good home has a moral duty to become a parent in his own turn. It is not the idea that the child must always be grateful to the parent. It is that the parent must in turn become a parent. The child cannot pay the parent, but society can. And all these different values become very, very important in society. So that if the individual was given a childhood and a loving care, and when he was helpless, was helped through emergencies, when that individual grows to maturity, he has his own family. And in that, he pays his debt. He pays it not to those who bought him, but he pays off by carrying forward the better levels of thought and action. He rewards his parents by disciplining his own children in their own turn. So that there is a reciprocity in all these things. We pay all debts. The debt of birth we pay when we give birth to others. Everything has an honor system related to it. And it is the loss of this honor system that, according to the Confucian concept, reveals the death of a civilization. When virtues fail, then there is only one answer, and that is a divine intercession of some kind. Also, as we go on further, the Chinese code says that we must prepare a livelihood that is suitable to our needs. And this livelihood is in no respect different from one level of society to another. Confucius said that the idea that some people's jobs are better than other people's jobs is completely unrealistic. Each individual doing the thing that he can do to the best of his ability is equal in every way to a person of greater talent who is doing larger things. In other words, the individual who uses his means and his abilities honorably is an honorable person, and there are no class divisions of this kind. There are only two kinds of people, those who are doing it right and those who are not doing it right. And those who are doing it right are all on one level, regardless whether they are a prince or a farmer. Those who do it wrong are also all on one level. Whether this wrong is small or large, they will ultimately have to pay for it. So Confucius was completely socialistic and democratic in his thinking. He did not feel that the mandarinate, or whatever was its equivalent in those days, the gentry, was privileged to consider itself a better kind of being. There is only one kind of betterment, and that's self-improvement. The individual who knows more and serves better and gives with a greater joy to the needs of others, that is the superior person. And all who are doing the best they can are superior and have the same values, the same recognitions, and the same rewards. The idea that some honest work is better than another is untrue. Very often, that which is not particularly pleasant is the most important work of all, and those who give themselves to it earn a great destiny. After they went on a little further, then does come the question as to what to believe. Well, how are we going to judge or believe the world around us, or what we might term the world within us? Confucius, of course, joined with many of the other ancient peoples of the world in a kind of ancestor worship. Now, we consider this completely unreasonable and worthless, perhaps because most people have ancestors they don't feel like worshiping, which is not unusual in these times especially. But ancestor worship in China and in many other countries is living up to something, not down to it. The individual regards his parents as a kind of superior virtue. If they've gone forth into the other life, they then become symbols of a continuing devotion, which is not interfered with by death. The parent becomes an image, the parental image of integrity. Now, the moral effect of this is quite interesting and has more values than perhaps we would first believe. A Chinese person who commits an evil action, either treason or bribery, robbery, violence, or anything of that kind, is not really just destroying his own character. He is humiliating his ancestors. He has failed them. They have given him a good life, and he has ruined it. They have given him the potential of great achievement, and he has betrayed them. And from somewhere on the other side of life, these ancestors are sad. They are brokenhearted to know that one of their descendants has committed evil. So that this becomes, in a sense, a strange persuasion against it, if you believe that your ancestors can know about it. Now, the other side of the coin is also just as difficult. If you have committed an evil act, this disgrace goes on to your children. Your whole family line is deformed. It is betrayed. The children have to accept the fact that their parents were not virtuous, that they were the progeny of an inferior code of life. So the child is humiliated unto the ninth or tenth generation by the crime of this one person. and the ancestors are humiliated back to the beginning of that family. Well, with this moral suasion behind a people who believe in it, you can see why it might have quite an effect upon the integrities of life. It certainly makes the person a little slow to feel that he is disgracing all who have gone before and all who are to come, in addition to disgracing his present family and all those who understand what has happened. So that ultimately the human being who does a wrong deed is disgracing the entire human family. He has done something unworthy of the tremendous preponderance of value which has been bestowed upon him by nature. He is not fulfilling the rules of rightness, and therefore it is a repentance. And the Chinese philosophy is very complex on this situation. Atonement is very difficult. Once an evil has been done, the family honor is lost. This is something we don't think about very much. We don't care. Maybe it's superstition. Who knows? But a superstition that makes people honest is perhaps a good substitute for a wisdom that they do not possess. It helps to fill a vacuum with an area of material factors the average person understands. He knows his family, and he knows families of other people, and he has heard of the sorrow that has been caused in this type of thing, and therefore he is more thoughtful. The Japanese have a similar practice. Once a year, they welcome their deceased ancestors back into the world of the living. They go to the riversides or streams or to the ocean side, and with little lanterns to escort their invisible ancestors to their home. When they get to the home, a special seat is placed for the ancestors at the banquet for the occasion. Nobody can see them, but everybody feels that they are there as a presence, so that the invisible ancestor has certain requirements. He must understand what has happened to the family since the last meeting. A year ago he was there, and everything was going fairly well, but this time grandmother is sick. This is a very serious factor, and may be something to be given very special consideration, because the ancestors deceased are very, very much there in spirit, if not in flesh. Also, the condition of the family. Has there been arguments between family members? Is there something that is in harmony in the family? Well, if there is in harmony in the family, there's been an unwritten law that it must be arbitrated before the ancestors get there, because the ancestors must be made happy by knowing that their children and their husbands and their wives and their all the family are living according to good principles. If this is not true, it is a serious disgrace. One other thing, which perhaps has a little more vital significance, is that all ancestors are very unhappy if a family is in debt. That is bad. If people are put off paying their bills, this is a heartbreak for the invisible relatives. Everyone at that time must have become solvent. There are cases known in which families have sold family treasures for ridiculously low figures in order that they could pay bills before that important day. But the parents must, who come visibly, or maybe some of them are still alive, there must be the respect that the family is out of debt. Well, we'd say these are all superstitions, but some superstitions do lead to constructive results. And for lack of them, and for the lack of anything better, a society can fall apart. So in the Confucian way also, the problem of government is very, very interesting. The Chinese emperors in the olden days had the annual ceremony of the Temple of Heaven. On that day, the emperor took off all of his royal regalia and put on the white cloth of a peasant. And he walked on a sand that a road that was covered with sand brought in from the desert of Gobi. And he made the pilgrimage with nothing but a knotted staff along the way of life until he came to the temple of heaven. Here in the presence of the gods and of his ancestors and the tablets of the constellations, the emperor addressed heaven, and he said something to this effect, that I am the representative of heaven. I have been entrusted to take care of heaven, but I've not been worthy. I've not done the things that kept my people happy. I've not been always fair in my judgments. But if there be trouble, if there be wrong, if there be anything that is not right, let the punishment descend upon me and me alone, for I am the leader of the people. And if they are wrong, it is because I have failed them. Now, this is a thought on politics. It's a thought that might have interest long after poor old Confucius went to his ancestors. Namely, that leadership has a strange kind of karma. The leader is responsible for the security of those he leads. When a leader exploits his people before heaven, the guilt is upon himself. This Confucius was reasonably sure of. And of course, in those days, the Chinese dynasties were falling like ripe harvest. Only a few years and another one took over, because everyone in turn became destructive, decadent, or dissipated. So Confucius pointed out that wherever problems arise, the leader must be held responsible. And if he cannot do something about it, then he must confess his infirmities. He must confess them frankly and honestly and ask the assistance of others to take on the things that he has not been able to accomplish. So the great ceremony of the new year was the constant acceptance of the way of heaven. So in Confucius, the whole thing sums up in the one great thing. The ways of men, and these ways may or may not be good, but the way of heaven is inevitable. The way of heaven is that which most needs attention. To know the way of heaven is the end of all learning. This is the quest of all scholarship. The end of the way of life is in this, that we should know the way of heaven is far more important than that we should split an atom. We have all kinds of learnings and researches and scientific corporations and groups exploring this and exploring that. But the one thing that we must explore, if we are to survive, is the way of heaven. We must find out what universal law requires, and we must keep that which we discover, regardless of any consequence to ourselves personally. And if we think we have discovered it and are supporting something that is not true, and we find that it is not true, then it is our need to recognize this and continue our search for the way of heaven. Shangji, the celestial emperor, is the source of all good. It is the universal principle of life. It is that which is alone qualified to lead, and all things must follow that leadership. Now this law, this the way of heaven, is a way of peace, of happiness, of securities, of kindness and compassion. The imperial power is compassionate. It is not something forever punishing. It is more anxious to reward. It does not punish anything, but things that break the rules punish themselves because they lose their harmonious relationship with life. The moment we break our trust with life, we come into infirmity. And this was what old Confucius taught. And I don't think right now, at least, we're going to be able to get the answer to this out of a computer. We're going to have to get it not out of instruments, but out of the living instrument in ourselves, the integrity which alone will enable us to do those things which are necessary to the survival of our people. Well, I guess that's all for today.